I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Manas Friedman, author of The Joy of Intimacy, A Soulful Guide to Love, Sex, and Marriage. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinshinim, Chen Denachi, and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. The hashtag MeToo movement has reached the Jewish synagogue world, and one of the first casualties appears to be the music of Rabbi Shlomo Carlebach. If you don't already know, Shlomo Carlebach was perhaps the most prominent and influential 20th century composer of American Jewish music, at least of the accessible kind. He wrote a vast body of liturgical melodies and songs heard in worship, summer camps, sing-alongs all over the world. His music is sung in temples of every denomination and no denomination. It was Shlomo Carlebach who brought extraordinarily singable, guitar-oriented tunes to camps and temples everywhere in the 60s and 70s. His settings for Essa Einai, Yedid Nefesh, Od Yishama, Lamana Chai V'Rei'ai, Kiva Moed, Am Yisrael Chai, and many, many others have become standards. Often, people sing his melodies and think they are singing folk tunes because they are so effective and accepted. But in the years after Shlomo Carlebach's death in 1994, numerous women came forward to allege that he sexually assaulted them. In the wake of the continuing allegations of men taking sexual advantage of women, and sexual advantage of men for that matter, that have become so focal in America over the past 9 months, Carlebach's music has now become controversial. It has been officially banned in some places now. In a sermon January 19th at New York Central Synagogue, one of the larger and more influential Reform congregations in the country, Senior Rabbi Angela Buchdahl announced that her synagogue will not sing Rabbi Shlomo Carlebach's melodies for a year. The moratorium is taking effect across the synagogue's program in services, Hebrew school, the preschool, and so on. We hope this communicates to those who have been victimized by Carlebach that we hear you and we are not indifferent, Buchdahl said. She is also a cantor, by the way. In this coming year, we will see what new music emerges in the vacuum that is created with Carlebach gone. Central Synagogue is one of several shuls in the U.S. across denominations that have stopped using Carlebach's name, his teachings, his stories are also famous, and his melodies in a debate that preceded but has now been intensified tremendously by the hashtag MeToo movement. The decisions are mostly an extremely belated response to sexual assault allegations that first appeared in a 1998 article in Lilith, the Jewish feminist magazine, and since then have continued to surface. Essentially, it felt like it was time to listen and take a reckoning to people we ignored who came forward with their tales of sexual assault, Angela Buchdahl said. We should not be in the business of banning any kind of art. I knew that was not the right option for us, but continuing to do nothing was also not an option. So Rabbi Buchdahl is not in the business of banning art or music, but she and Central Synagogue are doing exactly that, banning music. Not sure why it took 20 years after that article appeared or 24 years after Carlebach's death for this to happen, but a ban on Carlebach's music is what this is. Listen, to excise Shlomo's music from synagogue life will not be an easy endeavor. His melodies, recorded from 1959 until he died in 94, are often the most recognizable tunes to common Jewish prayers, particularly Kabbalat Shabbat, the Friday night service welcoming the Sabbath. Some synagogues have regular Carlebach services of his tunes, and there are Carlebach shuls in New York, Jerusalem, and elsewhere that use his music for their entire service. It will come as no shock to anyone active in the Jewish world that Shlomo Carlebach was known as a womanizer. But this sort of censorship of his music brings up the larger issue of just how we determine what sort of music or art or literature or poetry we use in public experiences, and how much we consider the composer or artist or author's life story in doing so. Do we need to evaluate the moral quality of a composer of music, or a painter, sculptor, writer, philosopher, before we enjoy their creations? If we begin with this kind of ban, does that mean we will eventually progress to, burning books? There is historical precedent. Notoriously, the Nazis gradually banned all Jewish artists, authors, composers, actors, musicians, conductors, singers, and all their works, while secretly stealing and selling works by Jewish artists to enrich themselves. And then they burned any books by Jews, along with all books they disagreed with. You know, we Jews have actually been on the other side of that process. Famously, the great composer and virulent and hateful anti-Semite, Richard Wagner's operas and orchestral music are not played in Israel to this day. That general prohibition began just after Kristallnacht in 1938, 10 years before Israel became a state. It remains largely in place today, 80 years later, although it is unofficial. Clearly, assaulting women is morally repugnant, and celebrating the work of one who has been repeatedly accused of taking advantage of the many women who were drawn to him and his music is wrong. And perhaps, since Karl Bach wrote mostly settings for prayer, using his tunes may appear to be antithetical to properly experiencing liturgy. But does this mean we now need a litmus test for every composition or arrangement used in Jewish religious services? Do we have to vet each piece of religious music for its creator's purity of life? What if they never assaulted women but were tax cheats or bad parents or deadbeats or criminals? What if they were just bad Jews or converted to another religion? What if the composers of the music we like were racists or just jerks? I have my doubts that most creative people in history were as pure as we might like them to be, or would pass a test based on our contemporary post-Harvey Weinstein morality. There are other Jewish composers who have spent time in prison for assaulting women, including a prominent folk singer whose music has been featured at Reform Movement events for years. And so far, their work has not been banned. Should it be? And what are we to make of the many lousy human beings who are also great artists, authors, poets, and philosophers? Should their work be excised from our society, too? Do we ban Hemingway as a brutal sexist, Ezra Pound as a vicious anti-Semite? Well, and then throw in almost every important author and poet in history for that sin, anti-Semitism, from T.S. Eliot to Voltaire to Martin Luther, all the way back to Chaucer. Shall we ban Picasso and Diego Rivera for incessant womanizing, Heidegger for Nazi party membership, Coleridge for drug addiction, Caravaggio for committing murder? What about Mark Twain? He was in the Confederate Army. Or Banksy, who sprayed graffiti everywhere? Do we ban all of their work? And if we do, doesn't this censorship serve primarily to impoverish our culture and our very experience of the world? I've always wondered, if women were really in charge, would they make the same mistakes that men have traditionally made? The hope was that having experienced persecution and oppression, women would be more enlightened in how they governed, more sensitive to the issues raised by reactively taking extreme measures like censorship or banning an individual's work. But I'm afraid we might be beginning to see that women actually do make the same mistakes men make, and they too will embrace censorship and artistic and cultural suppression readily when given the opportunity. Shlomo Karl Bach's music is being attacked and banned not because the music is sexist or oppresses women, it isn't and doesn't, but because he was sexist and probably took advantage of women. That confuses two very different issues. I can understand not celebrating Shlomo Karl Bach's life story, but to refuse to use his music crosses a line of censorship that is unfortunate and even dangerous, especially for Jews. And so to play us in this morning, here's our house rock band, Avanim, performing S.I.N.I. by Shlomo Karl Bach.
La 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 Lord, creator of heaven and earth. My help comes from the Lord, creator of heaven and earth. La-da-da-da-da, 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 la-da-da-da-da.
That was Sinai, Psalm 121, I lift my eyes to the mountains from whence my help comes. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Manus Friedman, author of The Joy of Intimacy, A Soulful Guide to Love, Sex, and Marriage. He has a great deal to teach us about creating fulfilling marriages in the age of divorce. Find out what when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish this morning, our guest, Rabbi Manus Friedman, whose new book is called The Joy of Intimacy, A Soulful Guide to Love, Sexuality, and Marriage. It's a remarkable and accessible and fascinating look at what you see as one of the principal problems of our society in our time. Tell us what prompted you to write the book.
It seems like there's a crisis in intimacy, that people have kind of lost even the definition of what it is. And so that even in a good, healthy, functional marriage, there are moments when people feel all alone in the world. And that's a symptom of a lack of intimacy. The intimate connection is not there, but there is functional connection. So I think it's a little bit of a crisis in our lives, and we need to fix it.
You note that people often confuse sexuality for intimacy, and that's partly a consequence of the sexual revolution going back to the 60s, perhaps, but there's more to it than that. Can you explore that a little bit with us?
Well, unfortunately, not only has sex replaced intimacy, but sex itself has become unhealthy. People are losing interest even in that, looking for alternatives. Every kind of exotic experience rather than the simple natural human condition. So we've basically lost our humanity in some sense.
In the course of exploring this over your years of work, what do you attribute that loss of the even concept of intimacy in deep personal relationship?
I think primarily because we've become a very materialistic society. We think in terms of things, and even people have become things, or at least there are certain things about people that we are looking for. We don't really get to the person himself. Like if a husband says, I love everything about my wife, and I ask him, but do you love your wife? He says, I love everything about her. I said, yeah, but do you love her? And he says, well, what about her?
This sounds like a song from Fiddler on the Roof.
Yeah, it might as well be, because it's the same problem. It's a universal, I think, human condition that we truly need intimacy in our lives. It is a genuine human need. It makes us human, whereas sex is not really a need. It's a pleasure, like chocolate. You don't really need it, and therefore it never satisfies.
I'm not sure about not needing chocolate. I don't know. That's
bad example. Yes. potato chips, okay?
Potato chips, okay. That need for intimacy, it's been documented from infants thriving because of getting maternal intimacy or any kind of human contact, and not if they do not all the way through life, but our society neglects that in so many ways. When we come back, let's explore how Judaism teaches us about that and some of your insights from this remarkable new book when we come back with Rabbi Manus Friedman. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Cohen Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Cohen and Irma Cohen, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Cohen Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Cohen Foundation Award, please go to CohenAward.com, CohenAward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is CohenAward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started speaking last week about the Jewish community of the former Yugoslavia, beginning with Belgrade, and talking about the ancients of the Sarajevo Jewish community, and began to talk a little bit about Jews coming back there now, returning, kind of reviving that Jewish community. Tell us a little bit about kind of the identity that the individual Jews have, because not exactly, you know, Jerusalem in the Balkans.
We'll start with a microcosm. I mean, first of all, one of the things that makes the Jewish community in the former Yugoslavia so interesting is that the former Yugoslavia combines a southern and eastern portion that were under the Ottomans for 500 years, and a northern and western portion that was part of Austro-Hungary. And there's even a suburb of Belgrade where we regularly go for pastry or lunch or something called Zemun, which was the southeast corner, the frontier outpost of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So you cross a river, basically, and you're visibly in Austro-Hungary. On the other side, you're in what was for hundreds of years part of Turkey. So obviously the part that was under Ottoman control has a lot of Sephardic communities and Sephardic traditions. The part that was under Austro-Hungarian control is Ashkenazic. And Belgrade, which was the capital, always had some of both. So it's a mixed community, and you see that most visibly and poignantly when you go to the cemetery, because following either a Balkan tradition or a Sephardic tradition, not sure which, on the graves of the 19th century Jews buried there, there are photos. And so in the photos, you can see who was dressed in a fez and Ottoman robes, and who was dressed in a Western-style suit and tie with the kind of hats that our grandparents would have worn. So, I mean, it's that in itself is extremely interesting and a rare exception in today's world. But the other thing that's important to understand about the Jewish community there is that because of the combined effects of the Holocaust and World War II and years of communist rule when the country was officially atheist and they even tried to stamp out Christmas, so many Jews my age are married to non-Jews. And a case in point is my host, whose parents were both Jewish, 100%. So by any criteria, legal or otherwise, he's Jewish.
Halachically Jewish.
Right. He married a woman who isn't. She's 100% Serb and Orthodox. And so his children, technically, by Israeli law or by strict halacha, are not considered Jewish. Now, they strongly identify as Jews. They went to the Sarvash camp. They participate in lots of community activities. And the daughter decided to go through the conversion process with an Orthodox rabbi and become officially Jewish. The son, who considers himself every bit as much of a Jew, is also a little bit more stubborn and said, there's no reason I should have to convert, and has so far refused to do this. Now, what happens when he has kids is another story. But again, halachically, it won't matter because his wife isn't Jewish. Whereas in Dina's case, the daughter, she is now halachically Jewish and up to anybody's strict standards. So her kids, again, no matter who she marries, will be Jewish in the eyes of Israeli law and strict halacha.
The fact is, in America, this is a common situation too. It's not so different there.
Right. Although I think both culturally and geographically, they're a lot closer to Israel, and the possibility of applying the law of return, sure. Aliyah, where to live in the future, those are all much more immediate questions to them than they are to most American Jews.
That's a great point. Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivi Na'an Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu visited India recently, returning a visit that Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi paid to Israel last summer. Very strong relationship now developing, and has been developing for a while, between India and Israel. Biggest Hindu country in the world. Also, by the way, a very large Muslim population. And Israel. Tell us a little bit about your perception of how all that's developed and why it's important for Israelis.
First of all, I'm happy that we have friends these days.
Yeah. Yes. We need friends everywhere we can get.
And this is not a small country. And let's face it, it's a lot related or connected to the trade relationship between India and Israel.
Steadily increasing business between India and Israel. A lot, fair amount of it in military hardware, mm-hmm. And expertise.
But not only.
Not only that, high-tech, lots high-tech. Of other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
On this trip, I think you mentioned before we went on mic that Bibi Netanyahu brought like 100 Israeli business people with him on the trip.
So yeah, together with Bibi and Sarah, 100 businessmen from Israel, businessmen and women joined the trip. And I know that they're expecting to sign some trade
agreements, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. While they're there.
There's been, we used to think about India as the place where Israelis went after the army. That's still true, of course.
Mamash.
In fact, when I was in the Himalayan area of India in Ladakh last summer, some people saw my yarmulke, and Israelis kept asking me if I knew the best place to stay in Hebrew or the directions to the next town, which was kind of funny because I didn't know where anything about the area. But now it's become a much more mature relationship. There was a really touching incident on this trip with one of the survivors of the Mumbai attack. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so what is it? Is it 7 or 8 years ago that, you know, a Chabad house was attacked and the rabbi and the Rebbitzin was killed, and one of the survivors, their younger kid, was brought to Israel and is now being raised by the grandfather and grandmother. And when Prime Minister from India came, you know, a few months ago.
Yeah, July. Last
it was July. Mm-hmm. And he met the guy. He met the boy, you know, in Israel. He met the survivor. And, you know, it was like very emotional meeting. And I think Bibi promised that, of course, the prime minister invited the boy to come to India. And Bibi promised him that when he will go, he will take him with him. So this was like a really
very touchy and
sad closure, but it was a
yes,
kind
of course. You know, the one thing I would add is I think that this relationship will continue to grow. Now, India was one of the countries that condemned Israel at the UN for President Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. But that doesn't seem to have had any impact at all on this trip or on the growing relationship.
Well, considering that the only one who supported it was United States. So they are only one of many who condemned it. And I don't know what else to say.
1.3 billion Indians still matter.
Condemnation that comes from the UN.
Well, it's an exciting moment and a continued development and a very important commercial and military relationship for Israel
India, of course, a major player in the world and in the world economy.
Mm-hmm.
I still remember what Modi said when he went to Israel last July. He stood with Netanyahu and he said, "Together, we represent 1/5 of the world's population."
Together.
Together, yeah. And if Netanyahu had left the stage, what it would still have been 1/5.
What India will do without us.
That's right. Thanks, Ashrat. We'll talk next week.
Bye.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. It's the advanced algebra class at the Jewish day school, and the math teacher asks the following problem. A rich man, Moshe, dies and leaves $220 million in his will. 1/3 goes to his wife, 1/5 is to go to his son, 1/6 to his close friend, 1/8 to his secretary, and the rest to tzedakah, to charity. Now, class, what does each one get? After a long silence in the classroom, Saul raises his hand. "Yes, Saul," says the teacher. And Saul answers, "A good lawyer." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Mishpatim includes as many laws as any other in the whole of the Torah. After the last few weeks of spectacularly dramatic portions featuring some of the greatest highlights in the whole of Jewish tradition, indeed all religious history, Mishpatim comes as a major letdown. Last week, amid the smoke and thunder of Mount Sinai, we received the Ten Commandments, the Aseret HaDibrot. The week before, God parted the sea for us. We miraculously crossed on dry land, and in the weeks before that, 10 plagues struck the Egyptians. Pharaoh and Moses had their duel of wills in the desert. But Mishpatim is nothing more than a collection of laws about how to interact with other human beings. We would call it civil legislation today. How exciting. How to handle somebody's property fairly. How to assess punitive damages for a man who injures another person or destroys someone else's property. How to act when someone puts his or her property in trust with you. The laws of manslaughter, of theft, of damages. Boring laws, many of them tediously detailed. And no one really likes reading law books. The Torah is truly our fundamental moral text, but this is an array of detailed legislation about human interactions so trivial as seeming not to belong in the Torah at all. So why do we have Mishpatim? Human beings have no love of law, or usually of lawyers, but without laws and without enforcement of them, we fallible creatures wouldn't function well at all. In fact, the Mishnah tells us we would tear each other apart. Where anarchy reigns, justice doesn't. And that's where Mishpatim comes in. For we need law, and we need limits, although we might not like either one very much. Judaism understands that if we are to be truly good or truly free, we must observe the laws and rules of human decency, embodied in the code of legislation that makes up Mishpatim. Because before we can love another human being as we love ourselves, we must respect that human being's property and person. Before we can make this world holy, we must treat each other with civility. This is a great fundamental lesson we seem to need to relearn in every generation, at every level of society. Freedom and holiness are dependent on the little laws established in Mishpatim, on the civility that rules require. May we all remember that this week and every week. When we return here on Too Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Manus Friedman, will explain why we so often confuse sex and love and focus on love when maybe we should be talking about respect. Learn how sex is also integral to creating a lasting marriage. All that when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The upper house of the Polish parliament, the Senate, has approved a controversial bill criminalizing allegations of Polish complicity in the Holocaust. The bill has caused a storm of opposition, a lot of it from Israel. The vote in Poland was 57-23. Poland's Senate's approval of the bill came despite assurances that a dialogue on the legislation would be held with Israel before it was voted on. It had previously been approved by the lower house of the Polish parliament.
The legislation, which still requires the approval of Poland's president to become law, bans any claims that the Polish people or state were responsible or complicit in the Nazis' crimes against humanity or war crimes. The bill also bans minimizing the responsibility of the real perpetrators for these crimes. The explanatory notes accompanying the bill say that it aims to fight expressions like Polish extermination camps, which purportedly attribute guilt for the Nazis' crimes to the Poles rather than Nazi concentration camps in Poland. The bill calls for imprisonment of up to 3 years for violations of this legislation. Both Israel and the U.S. protested to Poland and asked that the bill be rethought, saying it threatens free speech and open scholarship. Two teenagers beat an 8-year-old Jewish boy in suburban Paris in what French prosecutors are calling an anti-Semitic attack. The boy was wearing a kippah while walking in Sarcelles when the assailants, about 15 years old, knocked him to the ground and beat him. This is the second attack on a Jewish child in the same area this month. January 10th, a 15-year-old Jewish girl was slashed in the face while walking home from her private Jewish school wearing its uniform. French President Emmanuel Macron condemned the incident, saying, "An 8-year-old boy was attacked today in Sarcelles because he was wearing a kippah. Every time a citizen is attacked because of his age, his appearance, or his religion, the whole country is being attacked. It is the whole country that stands, especially today, alongside the French Jews to fight each of these despicable acts with them and for them." Earlier in January, two kosher shops in Créteil, another suburb of Paris, were torched 2 weeks after those same stores were attacked by individuals who painted swastikas on their fronts. In Tel Aviv, one of Israel's greatest men of letters, poet, journalist, author, and filmmaker Chaim Guri, died last week at the age of 94.
שיירות פרצו בדרך אל החיים בצדי הדרך הם מוטלים מתינו שלד הברזל שותק כמו רעים בבלואה
Chaim Guri's poem Bab El Wad and the song based on it refer to the narrow 14-mile road from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, called Shar Haggai in Hebrew, the Gate to the Valley, used for getting supplies to Jerusalem during the siege of the city by the Arabs during the 1948 War of Independence. Many young Israelis died desperately trying to relieve Jerusalem. Guri's life paralleled the formation of the State of Israel. Chaim Guri himself was born in Tel Aviv in 1923, just 13 years after the city itself was carved out of the sand dunes on the Mediterranean coast. Guri's parents came to pre-state Palestine on the same boat as Yitzhak Rabin's parents, and he credited the brilliant student Rabin a year older with getting him through high school. After high school, Guri joined the Palmach, the elite Jewish unit that became a top unit fighting for Jewish independence. He was one of the first recruits to complete the elite forces commander's course. He was sent to Hungary in 1947 by the Palmach to help Holocaust survivors emigrate to Mandate Palestine, then served as deputy company commander in the Palmach's Negev Brigade during the 1948 war. Chaim Guri's poetry, like that of his younger contemporary Yehuda Amichai's, captured something uniquely Israeli and helped forge the literary tradition of the young country. Considered the dean of Palmach-era Hebrew verse, his first published book of poetry, Fire Flowers, detailed his personal experiences during the war and gave voice to the pain and pride of Israel's first soldiers. Guri went on to write several other volumes of poetry spanning most of Israel's early military conflicts and iconic events. He made a name for himself as a successful documentary filmmaker and journalist. As a reporter, he gained prominence covering the 1961 trial of Nazi Adolf Eichmann. Guri still has the unofficial status of national poet because of his ability and willingness to evince sympathy for the nation. In 1988, Chaim Guri won the prestigious Israel Prize for his poetry, and he never stopped writing. His 2009 collection of poems, Eval, was published when he was 86. This translation of Chaim Guri's great poem, Heritage, is by Tet Carmi, my teacher. The ram came last of all, and Abraham did not know that it came to answer the boy's question, first of his strength, when his day was waning. The old man raised his head, seeing that it was no dream and that the angel stood there. The knife slipped from his hand. The boy, released from his bonds, saw his father's back. Isaac, as the story goes, was not sacrificed. He lived for many years, saw what pleasure had to offer until his eyesight dimmed. But he bequeathed that hour to his offspring. They are born with a knife in their hearts. May Chaim Guri's memory continue to be a blessing. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Rabbi Manus Friedman, who has written a wonderful book, The Joy of Intimacy, accessible, interesting, refreshing, and dealing with, as we discussed in the beginning of the show, this sort of lack of intimacy in primary relationship. Tell us, you know, how you think and how you explore in the book how people can build that intimacy and what Judaism has to teach about that.
First, I think we need a definition. What are we talking about when we say intimacy? And a good definition, as we started saying, is that an intimate relationship is a relationship that is clear and free of all things. As the sages said in the Mishnah, a love that is dependent on something will not last. A love that is dependent on no thing will last. So intimacy means the ability that two people have to connect to each other beyond all things, beyond even the most precious and the most valuable thing about your spouse. Even that can get in the way, because it should be your spouse and not something about the spouse.
Can you explain that a little more?
Nothing you get from your spouse, nothing about your spouse, can ever be more important, more precious than your spouse.
Can you give us an example of how something about your spouse can even get in the way of appreciating your...
Well, the most painful example is love. Love is destroying marriages much more than any other issue. Because ask anybody who's divorced, they'll say, well, it fell out of love. The love was gone. Which means that right from the beginning, they weren't married to each other. They were married to a mutual love. It's like two people love tennis. Should they get married? No, they should play tennis.
Even though, you know, in tennis, love equals zero. So
right. So if you both love the same thing, then do it. But don't get married. So if you love and you're in love, fine. What are you getting married for? Marriage needs to take you beyond all things, including love, including sexual pleasure. The media has convinced us, after trying long and hard, has convinced us that the essence of marriage is a good sex life or a love life. Those are things. You can love others. Your spouse is not the only person you love in the world. And sexual pleasure, does it have to be with your spouse? This is something that is more generic than marriage. Marriage has to be only you for me.
What does...
So you don't need, let me say really dramatic,
sure,
controversial statement. You don't need love from your husband. If you really need love, go home to your mother. And if your mother doesn't love you, that's a whole new problem. That's a different issue. But if you want love, if you need love, if you're looking for love, marriage is not the answer. You get married when you no longer need love. You need someone else in your life. You're ready to move past yourself to someone else. If you still need love, you're still taking care of yourself. Now, you don't need love from your husband. You need your husband's love. Just like you don't need love from your children. That's unhealthy. But you do need your children's love, which means it's because they're your children that you want their love. You're not looking for love itself. Because it's your husband, you want his love. Otherwise, you don't need love. And you can't get your husband's love from anybody else. So a mother would never say to her children, you don't love me? That's okay, you're not the only children in the world. Other children love me. That's ridiculous. You don't want love from children. You only want your own children's love because they're your children, because of who they are, not because of love. So the mitzvah to love your fellow Jew, is that because love is so important? No, it's because your fellow Jew should be important. There's a mitzvah to love God. Because love makes the world go round? No, God makes the world go round. So love is the appropriate feeling in a relationship with someone important. If he's important, love him. If she's important, love him. You don't love him, she's still important. So you'll love her tomorrow.
This begins to move a little bit towards the kind of challenging the whole concept of romantic love for marriage.
Yes. Love is not, you know, the old song, love and marriage go together like a horse and carriage.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not true. We've been misled. Love and marriage don't go together like a horse and carriage. First of all, the marriage is far more vital than the love. Love is flimsy. Love is flighty. And it should be, because that's what makes it exciting. So today I love you, tomorrow I won't, the next day I will. That's the nature of emotions. Marriage is stable, permanent, indestructible. It's a much greater. Also, love can be very selfish. I love you is a simple sentence, but it begins with the word I. I am the first word in the sentence, and you are the last word in the sentence. Love can be very selfish, whereas marriage, or intimacy, is interpersonal. It's not what I feel. It's us. Whereas I love you, that's all about me. And the proof is, I can love you deeply and truly, and you will never even know. I have to tell you that I love you, because my love is my experience, not yours. So love can't be the basis for the marriage. The simple definition of marriage is, number one, generosity. You got to be really generous to be married. Number two, dignity. You must maintain your dignity, because if you lose respect for each other, it becomes really ugly. Like familiarity breeds contempt. How do we avoid that in marriage? By maintaining our dignity. By maintaining each other's dignity, by respect. And the third thing is to know that marriage is not a human invention. Without the holiness of it, it really doesn't work at all.
So I'm going to follow up on that. At one point in your in the book, you say, no marriage is ever a mistake. And you quote Einstein, God doesn't play dice with the universe. So is a second marriage divinely ordained also?
Yes, and it's even ordained to be the second and not the first. And that's true of the third and the fourth and so on.
Is there a quota?
I think seven is the limit.
I'm glad to hear it. So if the first is divinely ordained and it doesn't work, I mean, even in the Torah, there's provision for divorce, you know. In Judaism, of course, while marriage is considered sacred, it's not indissoluble. If that's the case, it's a very interesting concept that it's beshert that the second marriage should be the second marriage or the third marriage should be the third marriage. How do you explain the first marriage then?
Well, it shouldn't be surprising that if every marriage is made in heaven, it might be too difficult to actualize on the human level. So the reason that every marriage is meant to be is because it's part of God's plan. It serves God's purpose for you to be married to your spouse. But God says, if it becomes too difficult for you, I will tell you, I will help you get out. So God invented divorce. So although he would prefer that you stay married, he's basically saying, if it's difficult for you, I will give you a way out. So it shouldn't be surprising that sometimes what God wants of us is a little demanding, it's high-minded, it's very idealistic, and sometimes it just doesn't happen on earth. So it's never a mistake. And it's a really dangerous concept that you got married by mistake and you have three children. So they're all mistakes. They should not have been born. The parents they have should not be their parents. What are we making out of life here? So no, it can't be that any marriage is ever a mistake. And it kind of makes sense because God does have a plan for his creation, and he doesn't want to see it fall apart, so he won't let it fall apart. And marriage is too important and too vital to the future of the planet for God to allow that to be a mistake and to let us make mistakes. So that's one of the areas in which he does not give us freedom of choice.
In reading the book, which begins by sort of exploring the problem and then moves towards aspects of how people who are married can find that solution, or people who aren't yet married can find someone with whom to share that intimacy. What do you think the most, is there a one size fits all? Are there specific ideas that are most helpful for people seeking greater intimacy in their relationships?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it leads us to another subject which needs a lot of attention. What is male and what is female? Why does marriage involve a man and a woman? In order to become truly connected, intimately bonded, you need like an attraction of opposites of sorts, that the male and the female complete each other so that they become one. They don't repeat each other. So you don't have, you know, two masculine psyches or two feminine psyches. You need to have a male and a female. And if we don't understand what that is and we don't believe in a difference between men and women, which is what the media kind of sells, then we don't know what we're doing in a marriage. So to be a healthy man, to be a healthy woman, to find that mutual attraction, that helps us become whole. It helps us become one. So we need to understand what is male, what is female. And we're so confused on that.
Can you clarify that a little bit? You know, obviously there's biological differences. What are you getting at?
Well, the biological difference is a reflection of a deeper difference, because we are created in God's image. So the soul that we carry is similar to God in that it has 10 faculties and the same faculties with which God creates the world. But then the body is created in the soul's image. So if you have a male body, it means you have a male soul. If you have a female body, you have a female soul. Now, in order to appreciate that, we have to know what is it that the male soul needs more than anything else? What is essential need of the male soul? And what is the essential need of the female soul? When both of them find that need in each other and can surrender to it, then you have the makings of an intimacy where the two can become one. Just to use a really graphic example, after people have had sex, it is not uncommon for one to ask the other, how was it? And this is really revealing. How was it? There was a thing that just happened here. There was me, there was you, and there was this thing. And that comes between you and keeps you separate. It does not bond you to each other. Secondly, why do you have to ask? Weren't you there? The fact that you have to ask, how was it, shows that you were busy with yourself, lost in your own experience, and now you have to check and see what happened to your partner. So sex does not bring us together. Sex takes us apart. Intimacy, on the other hand, means I'm putting everything aside. I'm transcending all stuff, all things. Love is not my thing. Sexual pleasure is not my thing. I want to be with you and nothing between us. That's intimacy.
So
according to Jewish law, mm-hmm. when you're being intimate, you're not allowed to be wearing anything. Nothing should come between you. There should be no distractions. There should be no television playing, no music going on. The lights should be off because intimacy is invisible. If the lights are on, you're going to see something. It turns out that our grandmothers were right. When I asked my grandmother, what happens in the bedroom? She says, nothing. And I said, come on, tell me. I'm 42. You know, you can tell me now. She says, nothing. I said, okay, fine, you don't want to tell me. But no, that is the answer. and it's the right answer. In a bedroom, no thing. No thing is welcome in the bedroom. It's reserved for him and her. And when they have each other, it's always good. You don't have to ask, how was it? We have each other. We're bonded. We're together. We will never again be alone.
It's beautiful. The book is out now. It's called, by Rabbi Manus Friedman, our guest. It's called The Joy of Intimacy, A Soulful Guide to Love, Sexuality, and Marriage. I want to thank you for a great visit here on Too Jewish. And where can people go to find out more about this otherwise?
It'sgoodtoknow.org. It'sgoodtoknow.org.
Great.
That's our website. And, of course, in finer bookstores everywhere.
Thanks so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be composer, arranger, and pianist Dave Schlossberg, whose debut CD of piano pieces has just been released. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from Chaim Israel, his song Mitoch HaHastara. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Abba, Shem HaShemayim, Omer Lanu, Anochi Aster Panai, Bayom Ahu. Aber Rab Nachman, Rab Nachman, Noime. Ve'afilu be'astara, she'betoch ha'astara, bevadai gam sham, nimtza Hashem itbarach. Be'afilu be'astara, שבתוך ההסתרה בוודאי גם שם נמצא השם ידברה. איי איי איי, גם אחרי הדברים הקשים העוברים עליך אני עומד, אני עומד, אני עומד. גם אחרי הדברים הקשים העוברים עליך אני עומד, אני עומד, אני עומד. ואפילו בהסתרה שבתוך ההסתרה בוודאי גם שם Hashem Yitbarach. Ve'afilu be'astara shebetoch ha'astara bevadai gam sham nimtza Hashem Yitbarach. Ay ay ay, gam achare advarim akashim ha'ovrim.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.